Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
What's it like reading Infinite Jest on its 20th anniversary? David Foster Wallace's editor, Michael Peach, and his friend Tom Bissell, who wrote the foreword to the new edition, will join us to talk about Wallace and his work.
Infinite Jest is a very, very funny novel about people in great pain, and through their lives shows people working through the many, many forces that can make life hard.
Why did American utopianism flourish in the 19th century? Chris Jennings will be here to talk about his first book, Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism.
The impulse is less about leaving behind a corrupt society, which I think is sort of the driving force of the communes in the 20th century, and more about actually changing the whole world. It was a very sort of active and global type of movement.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Michael Peach, the CEO of Hachette Book Group, joins us now to talk about David Foster Wallace. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
I'm thrilled.
So it is the 20th anniversary of Infinite Jest, and you have published a new 20th anniversary edition with a foreword by Tom Bissell. I mean, how did you decide, okay, now is the time to reissue this at 20?
As these big landmarks come along and a book is rising in importance and popularity and how much a part of people's lives it is, it's kind of the publisher's responsibility to acknowledge that and to seed the conversation and stimulate it. So we thought a new edition, new cover art, a new person to bring readers into it, and just a way to get the conversation out there again is something we're thrilled to be able to do.
And you were David Foster Wallace's editor.
Oh, yes, I had the enormous privilege of working with him on this book and some others.
This was the first book that you worked on him with.
This was the first, yeah.
So tell us the story. He had two previous books, The Broom of the System and Girl with Curious Hair.
Right.
How did this book sort of come to you, and tell us about your first meeting with him? And
I had been introduced to his work by his literary agent, who sent me some stories in obscure magazines, and which just blew the top of my head off. I was just enraptured from the first story of his I ever read. I got to meet him at one point when he was in New York, and this was the agent, Bonnie Nadell, doing her job preparing for David's future because she knew he was working on a new novel, and at some point she might have to consider who he would be published by. And there came a moment when I received a portion of the manuscript. I think it was around 150 pages. It was pretty much the first 150 pages of the book. If you've read it, you can imagine how much it leaves to the imagination. It's a bunch of different starts and pieces, but I was quite ardent to have the opportunity to publish it and was thrilled to win the chance to do so.
And you say to win the chance to do so. I mean, were people at that point sort of eager to sign him on? Was he sort of vetting people? How did that process go?
It was kind of a cult at the time. The agent doesn't say to you how many people they're talking to. I have the impression after the fact that she was just talking to a very, very small number of editors who she thought David might work well with, who he had kind of agreed to contemplate. I think it was really just between Little Brown and one other house, ultimately.
And so during those conversations, assuming that there were conversations with you and David at the time, did you get the sense that he was looking for something in particular from his editor?
He knew that he was writing something really big, just demanding on people's attention, and he wanted to work with someone who he felt he would listen to, and he somehow decided that he might respect what I had to say, or at least give it consideration. I think I came to understand later that he had not felt that had gone as he had wanted in the past, that he was too dismissive of his editors. Our mutual goal, what he wanted me to do, was help him make the book as short as it could be and still be itself.
So I want to talk a lot about the process, but before we get there, I'm going to assume that not all of our listeners have read Infinite Jest. So if you were the person doing the kind of the summarizing, the elevator summary, the barest description, what is this book about?
Infinite Jest is a very, very funny novel about people in great pain. It's a novel about a world in which entertainment and pleasure is abundant and so easy to get that it kind of is damaging to the soul. And it's a novel that goes deep inside a large number of people who are recovering drug addicts, alcoholics, and people in a kind of entertainment industry. And through their lives shows people working through the many, many forces that can make life hard.
In that description, you don't give the name of a main character, who the protagonist is, sort of what the plot is.
Yeah.
But if you had to do that...
It's yes, the plot, the story is, it twines basically two stories. There are outside Boston at an unspecified point in the future. There are on a hill outside Boston, there is a tennis academy, a family-run tennis academy, one of whose students is the son of the founders, who's a kind of tennis prodigy, and marijuana addict, a secret marijuana addict. And down the hill from that is a drug and alcohol recovery center, a home for people who have come through various legal reasons that they have to be in this program or they're going to end up in prison. So they're the strands of the lives of these two people in these two places and their lives twined together with a kind of a very hyperbolic, almost science fiction-y superstructure of a plot involving Canadian terrorists and an entertainment so good that it's lethal. People who sit down in front of this entertainment never get up again. They die watching it.
It's interesting that you said almost science fiction-y. Did David Foster Wallace think of this as science fiction?
No. I don't think that there was any intent to go that far. He wanted freedom to make fun of our world by going a little bit farther into the future. So, for instance, he imagined an America that has kind of taken over Canada and Mexico. America is so commercialized that every year they license the right to name the year. So the year is set mostly in a year called the Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, and it's followed by the Year of Glad and the Year of the Purdue Super Chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very funny, funny novel. The way David set out to do this was to make a book so funny that you would keep going through its great length and its great complexity of character and plot.
You mentioned that he gave you 150 pages to start and that you knew it was going to be big. Did you know it was going to be big in terms of length as well as in terms of its ambition and its scope?
He had given me an indication that it was going to be long. He just kept saying long. And you don't know how long is until you get it. It's a million words. It's a 1,000-page book, and it's got a lot of words on the page. And that 1,000 pages includes like 50 pages of very fine type footnotes, which are hilarious and essential. And one of the great pleasures of the book are all the layers of storytelling in here.
But they're actually not footnotes, right? They're endnotes.
You're right. Absolutely. Endnotes. We had a lot of conversations about whether they should be footnotes. They're commonly called footnotes, but you're right. We decided to put them at the end. Ultimately, it was David's decision, but we looked at putting them at the bottom of the page, and some of them are so long that they just take over pages and pages of the book, and we thought that they would make the book look even forbidding if you flip through it and you saw all these footnotes at the bottom of the page. It starts to look like a textbook. It starts to look scary.
Right.
And we thought having
this look super accessible.
Well, at least it's a pretty normal type page.
The book came out in 1996. When did he start writing it? How long was he working on it? When did he sort of hand in more pages to you?
I'm sorry, I don't have the chronology clear in my head. I know that between when we signed the contract and when it was published was something at least 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been working on it for quite a long, many years before that. The working process was it came in batches, and he would ask for response to a partial book, and it's really, really hard to give a response to a partial book because you don't know how much something matters until you see the whole thing. So I quickly realized all I could do based on these partials was tell him where I was confused and where I was finding it hard or slow. And sometimes confusion is the writer's intent. Sometimes the writer wants you to wonder about something. So all I could do was give him feedback about this section feels like a wall. People are going to have a really hard time climbing over sometimes. And others just, I'm racing through this. I'm dying with pleasure reading this. I laughed out loud here. So for a long time, it was that kind of response. And then finally, the entire manuscript was there and all the notes. And then we really dug into it.
How did he respond to criticism?
He responded to criticism. He was very engaged by this set of responses he was allowing one person to have before it went out into the world. He was funny about it. He took it seriously, and he was very responsive. He would sometimes write back, you know, doesn't matter. You could be the most persuasive person who's ever inhabited the planet, and I'm not going to change this.
Mm-hmm.
And other times, I recall there was one section early on in which he responded. I had suggested that I felt this brief chapter could be cut. And he said, well, it introduced three of the major characters and five of the biggest themes, but okay. Because there was, all those things did come up again and again in chapters around it. And he obviously, any change in a book accepted by the author, it's the author's work. It's not as though the editor has control of the book. The editor makes suggestions, and the author's free to disregard every single one of them or to take every one of them. But whatever changes the author accepts is the author's work. So I don't ever apologize for anything that might not be there that was there once. It was David's decision.
Is there anything that you feel like as his editor, if you had to sort of say one thing that you feel like an impact that you made on the manuscript or change that you suggested that you feel like that was the right thing, that was, and or David felt especially sort of thank you for suggesting X, Y, or Z?
There's a point about 100 pages into the book where he introduces a storyline involving some American government agents and Canadian government agents. And they start out, they're on a mountainside at sunset outside Tucson. And one of them's in a wheelchair and one of them is wearing women's clothing. And it's an extremely outrageous, almost farcical setting. And it's full of very serious content, and one of the characters speaks in a very, very heavy French accent, translated onto the page, and a great deal of information is conveyed in their conversation, and it was just hard to make sense of.
Hard to keep things in French.
There were quite a few conversations about why it was so hard and what might be done. And he came up with a solution. I don't recall precisely. It was something about the number of levels. I think it was that someone who was pretending to speak in a bad French accent was what he was trying to convey. And then mm-hmm. he realized it should just be someone speaking in a bad French accent.
They might not perceive that added layer.
He was very concerned that readers get to take it in, that they not give up. He wanted a book that people would not stop reading. And so anytime he felt that I was helping him do that, then he took the advice. And when he didn't, he just said, there was one scene that I recommended taking out because it came out very, very cleanly. It didn't really attach to anything else. And it was a great, great scene, but I recommend cutting it. And it was it's a scene called The Rise and Fall of Video Telephony. And it's one of the first things people talk about when they talk about how much they love the book. And he just said, you're out of your mind. I've read that aloud and people laugh like crazy. We need set pieces that people laugh at. And he was absolutely right.
We were talking earlier before this podcast about his nonfiction, which some people consider to be a kind of a gateway to his fiction. Specifically, we're talking about A Supposedly Fun Thing, I'll Never Do Again. And you were saying that there's a real relationship between that essay in particular and this novel.
The essay, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, is his story of going on a cruise ship. He was assigned by Harper's Magazine to go during a period when cruises were becoming very popular, just to go have that experience and write about it. I love reading that together with Infinite Jest because they share the impulse and that they're both about too much pleasure and the sadness that comes out of that. And they just twine around each other beautifully. I feel like people who have read and enjoyed A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again will respond very deeply to Infinite Jest.
Did David Foster Wallace, did he know how funny a writer he was?
David worked very, very hard at being funny. Yeah, no, he loved the pleasure of laughter. I didn't see him read in public many times, but he got a great audience response both from his written work and from his comments in real time, from his conversation. He was a very, very funny man.
Did he know the ending of this book when he went into it?
I can't answer that question. It's such a huge endeavor, and the book doesn't really have a clear ending. It's one of the things that the book talks about is what he calls anti-confluential drama, which is drama that has all the pleasure of drama, but without narrowing to a clear finish.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to the end of Infinite Jest, you start searching back for the clues that will help you understand the ending that might be layered within a footnote or a chapter much earlier, or even in the very first chapter, there's a clue to something very, very important. I think he had this very, very big construction in mind, whether he knew the ending.
And when you say that there's this clue, is that something that he told you about, that you immediately recognized yourself, that you discussed?
No, it's just that every story, there is a kind of a MacGuffin, and mm-hmm. the MacGuffin is this cartridge entertainment that is the Infinite Jest, the lethal entertainment. there's a big mystery about who it was created by and where it might have ended up. And there's a line about that in the very first chapter before you've even met any of these characters or have any idea that this is going to become of interest, but it's there right at the start.
And now, when the book came in and you had edited it and you showed it around to others you were working with at the time, what was the response? Did anybody say, wait a minute, we can't, this is too much, it's too big, or was there sort of universal acceptance and consensus?
As the book was coming in, there was a kind of cadre of friends within the company and outside of the company who were very excited by the books David had written before, who were asking about it and looking for opportunities to read it. So there was a great deal of excitement about it among people who cared about David's work and within the company and among writers out in the world. There were people dying to read it when it came in and to comment on it. This was a small group of people. Not many people had read his first two books. The sales were very, very small. But it was an influential group and a group of people with big voices. So our challenge was to activate those voices, to get them to help us talk about it, and to try to make the book's length not a problem, to turn it into an asset. That seemed really important. It felt really important at the time. I mean, there's just a human resistance to the idea of picking up 1,000-page books, and there had been a couple of really fat books that had come out in the previous couple of years by serious writers that I'd seen just go by without really getting much notice. So we worked hard in coming up with a campaign that basically set the challenge, are you reader enough for Infinite Jest?
Right. That's interesting. Very, very smart. Have you read the book again since David died?
Since David died, I have not read it in its entirety, but as soon as this 20th anniversary edition came in, I opened it up and started reading from page one again, and I'm at page 165 right now and just totally in love again. Just the thrill is immeasurable.
I mean, it's tempting, obviously, to read into it. There is suicide in the book. Is your sort of reaction to it at all different since he died?
As I'm reading it, I'm not having the experience of reading it with that in mind. I'm just reading something that a brilliant mind and spirit created. It's there for all of us.
That's presumably as he intended. All right. Michael Peach, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Peach is the CEO of Hachette Book Group and was David Foster Wallace's editor. Tom Bissell joins us now. He wrote a new foreword to the 20th anniversary edition of Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Tell us how you knew David.
So I knew who David was, obviously, long before I became friendly with him. I'd read, you know, all of the books that he'd written up till that time. But I became acquainted with him through Jonathan Franzen, who I've been friends with since 1996, right after I moved to New York City. And at one point, a magazine hired me to go through tobacco cessation, to take part in a tobacco cessation study, because I chewed tobacco like David Foster Wallace chewed tobacco. And Franzen put us in touch, and I think he and I had like a 3.5-hour telephone conversation about why we kept doing this objectively disgusting thing. And from there, sort of a friendship began.
Well, that's how most friendships arise between writers.
Yeah, and I have quit. I feel obliged to say that I no longer do that.
But since we're on that topic, before we get on to Infinite Jest, what insight did David have about the chewing of tobacco?
Addiction. This is all in Infinite Jest. It's a funny thing. You think I would have picked it up from reading the book? You know, addiction worms its way into your brain so completely that it implicates every decision-making motor in your head. And so at a very real point, your own mind doesn't have your best interests at heart, if you can tolerate that mixed metaphor. And Dave really made me realize that every time I tried to quit with like willpower or do it for this person or this person, none of that stuff was ever going to work. It was all doomed to failure. That you almost had to have, for lack of a better word, a kind of spiritual breakthrough about why you hurt yourself with these substances. And that was, keeping that in mind was really what allowed me to finally quit tobacco years and years later.
That does actually sound like a great insight. Is that, I'm assuming, in Infinite Jest? And had you read it before that point?
I had, yeah. And you know, when we were talking about this stuff, he could have just been reading sections of the book aloud to me. I mean, that's how much his heart is on his sleeve in those addiction sections in the book. I've read the book a couple times since that conversation, and I'll be damned if there's not a few passages where I can almost map them over each other one-to-one from our conversation. And, you know, the more times I've read it, the more I kind of respect what he was doing, because I touched on this in my introduction, and I think it is a book, in a lot of ways, that is fascinatingly at odds with itself. It's got these three driving storylines. There's really four, but let's just, for the sake of argument, let's say there's three. One of them is this kind of Lord of the Rings-esque study of this entertainment that everybody is pursuing. And that story happens around the edges of the book. And the other is this really kind of hardcore portrait, one of the most beautiful psychological portraits I think I've ever read, of a recovering addict named Don Gately. And then one, I think, is the part of the book that's closest to Wallace's heart, which is the story of Hal in Candenza and his family and this tennis prodigy, this lexical prodigy, coming of age and not realizing that his father, in fact, spawned this entertainment that is capable of ending the world. And these three stories all sort of intersect and crisscross with each other, and yet they don't really pay off in the sense that a traditional novel would pay them off. The end, as a lot of people know, is actually in the first 10 pages of the book, mentioned in a sentence, because the book sort of stops before these three stories all converge, as you're expecting them to. And you have to go back and read those difficult first 40 pages to find a one-sentence mention of what actually happens when the book cuts off. And I find that such an interesting decision that he made. And in a book that critiques entertainment as a pursuit, I think the cross-purpose he put himself to was he couldn't have a book that critiqued the condition of being entertaining that was sort of so propulsively entertaining. He actually had to throw up these roadblocks in front of you to remind you that the book is actually a critique of the thing that it often is, which is this grippingly addictive, beautiful story.
And yet, in talking to Michael Peach, his editor, our guest just before, he said that David really wanted it to be funny so that people would keep reading.
I think it is one of the funniest novels I've ever read. And when I was looking for sentences to quote in my foreword, just paging through it, I think I filled up, three pages of sentences that just make your hair stand on end. And sentences that are so funny and so beautiful. And it is a really funny book. And instantly when you meet an Infinite Jest hater who claims that they tried to read it and couldn't and found it unreadable, and you ask them, do you think it was funny? And if they say no, one of two things. They're lying or they have absolutely no sense of humor.
That's true. There can be a litmus test. One interesting thing about Infinite Jest is he wrote this presumably in the early 90s. I don't know if he began it even before then, but it came out in 1996. Yet you call it the first great internet novel. Why?
The book anticipates a kind of entertainment that grabs hold of us and doesn't let go. That I think Dave looked into television and saw this metaphor for this thing that is so watchable, so brain-erasingly watchable, that it creates a nation of people who are literally entertaining themselves to death. And he got there from television. Marshall McLuhan, I think, said something kind of similar before Dave, but Dave embodied his fears in fiction rather than cultural critique. But when you project forward 20 years later, and if you can tell me that you don't see in the metaphor of the entertainment of the film Infinite Jest and the book Infinite Jest as an analog for things like Netflix, things like 60-hour-long video games, things like social media, where you're just constantly hitting a refresh button and devouring, as I say, the ordinary thoughts of your friends and yourself. I think the film in the book is predictive of a lot of that stuff, not in a one-to-one sort of way, but definitely in a spiritual way.
Reading this novel now, after David Foster Wallace's death, is this the first time that you read it since he died?
It was the first time since he died that I'd sat down and read it all the way through again. And I will not lie and say that there's parts of it that were really hard to read. I didn't know Dave as well as like his closest friends did, but we knew each other pretty well. And we spent a lot of time sort of reacquainting ourselves, 6, 6 or 8 months before he died, we had this great flurry of phone calls and letters, and I went out and visited him and Karen, his wife, and had a really nice weekend. And, you know, 6 months later, he was gone. And so I kind of feel like that last flurry of activity made me feel like, you know, I remember leaving and thinking, wow, David and I are going to be much closer friends now. I'm really happy about that. And I don't think I was really prepared for the way he was going to go, like a lot of his really close friends were. Reading the book, there were parts of it that, you know, when characters talk about their depression, you get a glimpse of some of the stuff I think he had felt and wrestled with his whole life. In particular, Kate Gompert has a wonderful, painful, painful section where she talks to this resident doctor about what depression feels like, and she likens it to needing to throw up, that feeling that I need to throw up, but it's not just in your stomach, it's in your whole body. And I will tell you that when I came to that section and read that, I kind of had to put the book down, and I wondered to what degree that was an autobiographical sentiment. And if it was, I feel, and I'm not the first person to say this, that, you know, his perceptiveness and his sensitivity to the world around him was both, I think, for him, his great blessing as a writer, but I think it manifested itself emotionally in ways that I think made it very hard to be David Foster Wallace sometimes. And it really filled me with a lot of anguish, you know, as someone who loved him, both as a person and as a writer.
Some people, our listeners, will have read Infinite Jest and know exactly of what you speak, but of course others haven't. And if there's one thing that you could say that would pique people's interest in this book 20 years later, what would it be?
I think the first thing I would say is how funny it is. And it's funny in both a slapstick way, and it's funny at a linguistic level. I mean, he has a way, he puts English on his sentences in a way that is really inventive and completely new feeling. You know, a lot of people have tried to write the way the kids are talking these days, but he just didn't write like that. He thought like that. And all these new technologies that had sort of come up in his and my and our lifetimes, he somehow knew how to pinpoint in language on the page and make it seem naturalistic. And that is, I think, one of his greatest accomplishments. Another thing I would say is that its hold of character, its view of character, is really deep. And I've never read a book that has more characters in it, many of whom are very different from each other, and yet they all feel unbelievably real. A lot of people praise the book for its sentences, for its Pynchon-esque science fiction-y plot, for its predictiveness. But to me, the things that make the book that it is, are the beautiful sentences and his empathy for his fictional people as a writer. And those are the things that I think everyone from, you know, George Eliot to Jane Austen to Herman Melville to Saul Bellow to Marilyn Robinson today all have in common. They care about the sentences, and they care about the lives and well-being of these people that they invent on the page.
Tom, it's no wonder that you wrote this excellent foreword, which we excerpted in the book review this week. Tom Bissell, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Alexandra Alter is here to talk about what's going on in the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
We're going to forgive Alexandra her cold.
Thank you very much. Just recovering. So the big news this week is that Amazon, which, as you know, opened its first brick-and-mortar bookstore in Seattle last year, is planning to expand with more physical bookstores. The big question is how many and how quickly. And there are a lot of rumors flying around earlier in the week when the CEO of a mall operator called General Growth Properties said that Amazon was aiming to open 300 to 400 bookstores.
That's a big number.
It's pretty big. I mean, you think about Barnes & Noble has just over 600 retail stores at this point. That would, you know, give them a big toehold in the whole market. Of course, they backtracked from that and they said that was not exactly the right number. And this was not Amazon saying it. Amazon wouldn't comment publicly on speculation, but it did cause a lot of speculation and even some panic. Barnes & Noble stock fell almost 10% on Wednesday after this news came out.
Wow.
So people are taking it quite seriously. Since that rumor started, some more details have come out. The publishing website Shelf Awareness, which is well-run and well-sourced in publishing, said that Amazon's plans are more modest. They're looking at about a dozen stores. Other places reported, including the New York Times, that people familiar with Amazon's plans said they were looking at, you know, a handful of stores in the next 1 to 2 years.
Amazon stocks took a tumble recently as well, didn't they?
Well, they had an earnings report, which was very positive, but not as positive as people had expected.
This was looking at their sort of their Christmas results?
Exactly, reflecting holiday sales, and people expected it to be boom times, and it wasn't quite as good. But I think investors, you know, have always given the company a lot of leeway for experimentation, mm-hmm. and this is probably one area where they're continue to do that.
So let's talk about the stores themselves. What are they like? How are they different?
Right, they're very different. I mean, so far we only have one model, the Seattle store. It's partly curated based on online recommendations, which is an interesting fact. They feature a lot of Amazon devices, the Kindle and the Echo, as well as physical books, and all the books face out. There's a little section of recommended books by Jeff Bezos, Amazon CEO, which includes his wife's book, charmingly.
Mackenzie.
Exactly. But, you know, they are always tinkering with things. And one of the interesting details that came out this week, it was reported by Recode, actually, that the person who's going to be leading their bookstore initiative is Steve Kessel. He's a longtime Amazon executive who helped launch the first Kindle e-reader, and he's very close with Jeff Bezos. And the other thing that Steve Kessel was involved in was applying for a patent, which kind of suggests a little bit about what the store will be like. One of the...
Everyone's reading the tea leaves here.
Exactly. One of the aspects of the patent, it was a retail kind of experience where somebody could walk into a store, grab something off a shelf, and walk out without ever stopping at a cash register. The other thing that came out is, you know, just as Amazon is, you know, not commenting on their plans, people discovered a job posting for booksellers in the San Diego or La Jolla area. Just in case you think you might be qualified, here's what they're looking for in the job posting. Quote, "You love the excitement of running a bookstore. You have a flair for leading teams and adjusting your leadership style based on the situation. You enjoy reading and keep yourself updated on the latest in the digital device front." Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that sounds like
when I worked at B. Dalton in the 80s, we did not have that in our job description.
It really shows how the bookstore is not going away. I mean, that was a fear a few years ago when Amazon was growing so quickly. People were panicking. Independents were closing. You know, Borders went out of business. Now we're seeing a real resurgence, not only in the number of independent bookstores, but in their sales and revenues. And I think there's now an understanding within Amazon that, you know, physical bookstores are actually still the best place for people to discover new books, things they didn't really know they were looking for. And they want that to be one facet of their overall kind of domination of the book market.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, even when Borders sort of went down, people didn't ask, was it a question of there not being a market, or was it a question of sort of this company or this, you know, this particular company not doing the marketing well or not serving the market
right.
well.
And I mean, one of the things that they did at the end was kind of throw everything at the customer. They went beyond books. They started, you know, expanding their retail offerings.
You're seeing like books and music and TV.
Exactly. And you're seeing Barnes & Noble sort of doing the same thing. And it's a reasonable thing to try to, you know, continue to get the broadest customer base possible. But at a certain point, you wonder if you're alienating your core audience, people that are there for the books themselves. And so I wonder if that might contribute to the fact that Barnes & Noble has been really struggling, whereas independent booksellers as a whole have been doing better.
I had lunch with a friend yesterday who'd visited the Seattle store, and she made an interesting point. She said that a lot of bookstores display books. The Amazon bookstore sells books.
Oh, that is interesting. That's a good distinction.
So we'll see if that's a prediction of sorts.
Yes.
All right. Alexander, thank you.
Thanks.
Chris Jennings joins us now. He is the author of Paradise Now, the story of American utopianism. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is your first book, right?
It is indeed.
And how did you come to this subject?
I sort of stumbled into it. You know, I was sort of interested in an amateur way in 20th century communalism and hippie communes and that sort of thing. And that led me to the earlier 19th century history of American communalism. And I was just immediately captivated by these strange people.
Is there an obvious through line between, you know, a group like the Shakers and the Haight-Ashbury kind of hippies?
I would say there's less of a through line than people generally like to think there is. You know, all of these things get sort of filed under utopian communities. And I think that there's something
particularly utopian about the groups that formed in the 19th century as opposed to the 20th century. The impulse is less about leaving behind a corrupt society, which I think is sort of the driving force of the communes in the 20th century, and more about actually changing the whole world. It was a very sort of active and global type of movement. So I think there's some pretty fundamental differences. But in very practical ways, the places looked similar, you know, run-down farms with people sleeping on every surface.
When you look at these 19th century movements, is there something especially of that time? Why then? Why did these arise during that period?
I think that there was sort of a confluence of forces that made these ideas appealing to people in that time. I mean, what I think is most interesting about this chapter of American history is that these are very, very smart, reasonable, hardworking, sort of familiar to us Americans, you know, bankers and preachers and farmers, sort of salt of American society, who are adopting some extremely radical ideas. And so that's sort of what's most exciting. And I think that the reason, the circumstance that allowed that to happen was a confluence of what was going on in religion at the time, the sort of Second Great Awakening and the surge of millenarian religion, you know, the belief that the sort of golden age that's promised to us in the Bible was on the brink of commencing, and a sort of enlightenment sense that the world is going to continue to improve, you know, with each passing decade. And that sense was sort of peaking after the American Revolution, both here and in Europe. So those are sort of the driving forces, this religious idea and this distinctly secular enlightenment idea kind of merge.
You divide the book into five sections, looking at five different movements and starting, I think, as many would expect, with the Shakers. What are the other four?
The other four are, so after the Shakers, I talk about the community of New Harmony, which is in Indiana, founded by Robert Owen, a Welsh industrialist and socialist who was influenced by the Shakers. He comes over in the 1820s. And then the next group I write about are the Fourierists. And there I write both about Charles Fourier, who was the man whose ideas were picked up by a lot of Americans in the 1840s. He himself never comes to the U.S., but he has several very passionate followers who spread his ideas in the U.S., and they established communities all over the northern part of the country in the 1840s. And from there I go to the Icarians, who are French communists, followers of a guy named Etienne Cabet, who was sort of the leading communist in France for a little while. And they come also in the 1840s to Texas to try and build their sort of utopian community and end up moving to Illinois, then Iowa, and finally California. And then the last group, which is the only of these groups that doesn't have its origins in Europe, is the Oneida community, which a lot of people probably remember from high school history class, but they were in upstate New York, a sort of community devoted to what they called Bible communism and perfectionism. And they most famously practiced a sort of free love.
As you said, four of these groups had origins in Europe, but were they fundamentally American?
I think they were fundamentally American because there was some, I mean, for their founders, who generally were getting their start in Europe, there was something about the presence of the North American continent sort of across the ocean that inspired them to think that these ideas, which they were, you know, cooking up in London and Paris, were plausible. This sort of emptiness of, or at least what they imagined as the emptiness of the North American continent, inspired their utopianism. And then, of course, the people who populated these communities were, for the most part, Americans. The Icarians were the only ones who in which the actual citizens of the community came from Europe. They were mostly French, but the rest were the ideas might have been European, but the people trying to put them into action were American.
Let's start with one of the founders of those movements, and perhaps the mother or ghost of all of them, Anne Lee. Who was she?
Anne Lee was a person who, if she hadn't had a series of religious revelations, would be completely lost to history. She was born in a sort of a slum, basically, in Manchester at the very early stages of the Industrial Revolution. And Manchester, of course, becomes sort of ground zero for industrialism, you know, across the globe. It's where the textile industry booms. And that was sort of the first industry to make use of
large new machinery and mass production. So Lee is born into extremely impoverished circumstances. We don't even really know the name of her mother. And the same would be true with Anne if she hadn't taken up with a small prayer group, which she eventually becomes the leader of. And they're known around Manchester as the Shaking Quakers, because one of the way they express their union with God is by sort of shaking and leaping around. And she becomes the leader of this group and decides to bring them to the United States to build what she thinks as the sort of stronghold for the millennium that she thinks has begun. Her revelation is that God doesn't want us to have sex. And once we stop having sex, the perfection of the human race and the earth will commence. So she's trying to get that ball rolling. And she comes over here and she dies not that long after, just after the revolution. And a series of very intelligent and capable successors help expand her idea into an enormous national movement, the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing, which is what the Shakers called themselves. Shakers was originally sort of a derogatory term that they eventually made peace with. They spread across the whole country and are for a while very very common presence in America.
One of the things that all of these movements have in common, obviously, is a tremendous sense of purpose and optimism. And I'm curious if you thought about that as it relates to our current political movement, which seems to be one of deep pessimism.
Yeah, I think that was probably what made me most attracted to these people and wanted to write about them. Their errors are abundant and easy to see, so I don't think I would have wanted to spend so much time amidst them if I didn't find them inspiring in some ways. And the fact that their entire existence was sort of oriented around a vision of the future, I think, is something that is lacking from our contemporary political scene. That the appropriate way to critique the present is to describe an idealized future, I think, is a very valuable approach.
I'm assuming that these five movements had their differences, but what were the common themes and then what were the main points of departure?
Yeah, I think what's most amazing about them is what they had in common. Just to start with where they differed, for instance, it's sort of amazing that the Oneida community, whose leading principle was free love, felt such solidarity with the Shakers, whose leading principle is no sex at all. And I think while those two things seem very different, they actually revolve around the same basic idea, which is that all of these communities sought to abolish the family as the sort of base unit of society. And that was an idea that sounded precisely as radical in 1840 as it does today. Then as now, the family was sort of the basic political unit, the basic social unit. And all of these people saw the family as a sort of obsolete institution. They also all shared basically a strong socialistic vision. They thought that private property would eventually disappear and that all people had to be materially equal, not just the sort of equality of opportunity that is written into American founding documents. One of the things that really made them radical in their day was pretty much all of them had a strong idea of male and female equality, which was not something that people were comfortable with in the middle of the 19th century. So there was a lot more that they had in common than separated them.
There have been obviously books about each of these groups before and some of them together, but what did you want to do by looking at these five together in one book?
I think I wanted to describe what I saw as an era that can probably be described as the golden age of American utopianism, a moment when this utopian impulse was at its highest point. I think these five suffice to capture that moment. They were not in their time. They were recognized by their fellow Americans as being somehow related to one another. The Oneida community is this crazy free love experiment, and the Shakers are this deeply religious experiment in abstinence, and the New Harmony is this expressly atheistic community. So you would think that they were not seen as being sort of fellow travelers, but they were.
We're obviously in early days now, but are there 21st century equivalents?
Thus far, I do not see anything that captures the enthusiasm and sort of the depth of the utopianism of the 19th century. Obviously, there's, you know, progressive movements and people who have alternative ideas about how to live, but a sort of national surge of of creative thinking about the future is not something I see happening anywhere, and I think that that's a shame, though obviously there's good reasons for it. The 20th century did a lot to cure us of our desire for grand transformative visions of the future. There was a lot of blood spilled in service of such ideas. So we're appropriately wary of such ideas now, I would say.
Well, we've got 84 more years to let you down, so we'll see what happens. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Chris Jennings is the author of Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism, reviewed this week in the book review by Kirk Davis Swinehart. Greg Coles is here now to talk about bestsellers. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
On the fiction side, there are three new titles, starting with a novel called The Swans of Fifth Avenue down at number 9. That's by Melanie Benjamin. Do you know who that is?
I do know who that is.
So she wrote a novel a few years ago called The Aviator's Wife that was also a New York Times bestseller. That was about Anne Morrow Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh's wife. Before that, she had a novel called The Autobiography of Mrs. Tom Thumb. This is kind of her thing. She goes back into history and resurrects an actual historical figure and builds a novel around them. In this case, the historical figure is Truman Capote, and specifically she's looking at his friendship with the socialite Babe Paley. At number 6, Brandon Sanderson continues his Mistborn fantasy series with a novel called The Bands of Mourning, new at number 6. That's Mourning, Mourning. Then finally, at number 1, James Patterson continues the NYPD Red series that he's been writing with Marshall Karp. That one is creatively called NYPD Red 4. It is unsurprisingly the fourth book in the series, new at number 1.
All right, moving to nonfiction.
Nonfiction, there are just two new titles. At number 14, a guy named Mohammed A. L. Aryan, who used to be the CEO of PIMCO, that huge bond firm in Southern California, has written a book called The Only Game in Town. He wants to emphasize fiscal policy over monetary policy. So he's arguing for central banks everywhere to play a smaller role than they do, and that the political system should be more involved in building up the economy.
All right. The other one.
The other one is at number 10, a book called Cure by a science writer named Jo Marchant. And she's especially looking at the mind-body link, the role that our psychology, that the mind plays in helping us get over diseases.
I want to talk just really quickly about the top books on the nonfiction side. Because they are, I'm showing my card, such great books. It's really nice to see. We've got When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. Number 2, Dark Money by Jane Mayer, a previous guest here on the podcast. And then at number 3, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, just a juggernaut of a book there, one of our 10 best. Bill Bryson, also here as a podcast guest, The Road to Little Dribbling at number 4. And then The Pope, who can argue with that? The Name of God is Mercy at number 5. It's just nice to see.
Yeah, and all of those books have been doing well for a while now. This is the second week in a row that they are holding down the top 5 positions.
All right, let's keep it going. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.